Welcome to the Becoming More Significant podcast. And this is all about helping you to become more visible, more credible, and ultimately more profitable by becoming more significant. And you have a smorgasbord of offerings to tap into. So over 50 wonderful podcast conversations with incredibly inspiring guests, each of whom are being truly significant in the world. And they're sharing wisdom and insights that helps them to continually have an ongoing impact in the world by being ever more significant. Then I have 10 Wisdom and Insights episodes where I have captured the golden nuggets from those conversations. And in each Wisdom and Insights episode, I share from either 5 or 6 episodes the key learnings, the insights, and the practical actions that we can all take right now to become more significant in the world. And then my third offering is some snapshots of the learning that I have been doing over the last few years. I am a learning junkie. I'm constantly keyed into audiobooks, to podcasts, to TED Talks, to online courses, to mentoring. And I'm learning so much all the time that I'm sharing with my clients. And so I want to do that through the podcast platform as well. So I will be putting together very short, probably 15, 20 minute sessions on key learnings and again, key actions that can help us all to become more focused, tap into more of our potential and make a real and lasting difference in the world. So lots to choose from. And thank you so many of you for supporting the podcast over the last couple of years. It's been great to have you on board. And long may you continue to tap into the wisdom and gems of the Becoming More Significant podcast. Wherever you are today, I hope you're shining brightly. Have a great day. So I am really delighted today to have a guest on board that I've wanted to have a really good conversation with for ages. So welcome, Derry Llewellyn Davies.
And only a Scots person can say that properly, right? So it's I normally get these Americans and these English just can't quite get that twang like you do, Sylvia. So it's a pleasure to be here.
So Derry, for the benefit of our listeners, could you just introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about you and a little bit about what you're doing at the moment.
So I've been known on the stages for quite a long time as the strategy man now. And that's the essence of my background. I've been business. I love business. I'm deeply in all, and I've been fascinated with this for over 2 decades. And strategy is still core of what I do. However, I kind of like life too, right? So I'm a big adventurer. I'm sure we will come on to adventures at some point in this. But along the journey that I've learned along through the adventures and business, I just love architecture, whether that's architecture of a business or architecture of life, architecture of ourselves, right? As with this health optimization, whether it's meditation, mindfulness, whatever. So my new brand is kind of moving much more Derry.live into, I want to have wider conversations, okay? So for those who know me as strategy, don't worry, it's not going to be all strategy today. Sylvia can ask me what she likes. It's been full permission. And I'm actually building much bigger things, much more impactful things for the world, which we'll come on to in time. So I'm building out a country estate model out here in the Welsh borders, which we're looking to expand globally. But in its true essence, we're here to make an impact, right? So this is what Sylvia's all about, which is impact and significance. And, you know, my job is to build businesses that empower people to do that. So, and this is the thing, I think business is one of the greatest tools, if used properly, to create massive impact in the world. And let's just face it, I don't think the politicians are going to solve our problems. So but I do believe the business leaders can, if they can stand together in force and actually do business for good, which is what I believe in.
Brilliant, lovely introduction. So Derry, we are going to come on and talk about the, you know, where you are now and the adventure and everything. But, you know, when I was reading up about you, you started 20 businesses. Can you kind of talk us through that? That's a hell of a lot of businesses to start in a lifetime.
Do you know what? That's an old statistic. There's a lot more now because I've got about 10 in play right now. It wow. sounds like a big number, actually, but there's also a lot of failures along the way. Let's just be clear. And a big part of my message is your first business isn't your last business. Mm-hmm. Because I started businesses, my first business I started, oh, I show my age now, 22 years ago. So I went through a whole phase and I bought and I sold. I've exited. I've just shut things down because they weren't the right things. So you got to know when it's the time, right? And I've evolved. So some of those were small, some of those were big, but they've all been part of my journey. Interestingly, now the portfolio I have is, I think, more is significant than ever before. But that's 20 years of learning, right? Mm. And now for me, I keep adding businesses because of the scale I'm at now. It's like we just add another business. So it's actually, don't look at it as an egoic thing. It's actually a structural thing. It's actually smart business and strategy to keep your businesses in containers that are relevant. So strategy on a page was one of my first book and my methodology that I've been speaking about for years, which is still my CEO, Ian, runs that business now, which is, and he's brilliant, better than me, by the way. So in that methodology, it's like, if you've got like a speaking business, as we know, Sylvia, it's very different to like a online business. So they actually justify different structures if they're going to be at a big, big sale. So don't, I've got no ego behind the number of businesses I've built. What I'm more proud of, by the way, is the 300 businesses I've been on the board of. And the ones I've served along the way. So, and by the way, the reason I've got the badge to serve those 300 is because of the mistakes I made on the 20 I built myself.
So those 20 businesses, was that when you created the strategy on the page? Was it running those businesses and the learnings from them?
100%. It was a combination of those. I came out of the corporate world. My career is very split. My first half of my career was corporate. So I rose through the corporate ranks and ultimately ended up as European board director of a large global conglomerate. And then the second half has been all about the SME world. And those worlds are really interesting because they're very different. And yet there's a lot of lessons both ways. And that's what I kind of bridge the gap on both ways of that because of my experiences. So strategy on a page came from two things. First, by that point, I'd done, I think, probably around 15 businesses when strategy on a page. And strategy on a page was built from the brutal lessons I learned.
Okay.
And how I got it wrong. Because I didn't build a purposeful business. Purpose is at the center of everything I do now. And that's always been the center of all my keynotes. I've always put purpose right in the middle. What's the purpose of this business? And my first eight businesses was nowhere near it. It was make money, right? That's my first eight. And that's a soulless journey, as I discovered, right? Mm-hmm. You tell that to 20-year-old me, and I would have said, told you to get stuffed, right? So it's a journey. But then equally, I was sitting on a lot of boards early. A lot of people were asking me on as non-exec directors and as advisory board levels. And it was only after, it was about the first 100 companies I had advised at board level and I'd run 15, suddenly I was like had the epiphany of, oh my God, it's always the same stuff. Mm. Now, there's no coincidence. When you run one business, you think it's all your pain or you think it's you or it's your problems and you can go really into it. Once you've seen 100 people's problems and 15 of your own, and you recognize that, oh, it's the same shit all the time. Why hasn't anyone else joined those dots up yet? So I was very blessed that I had that spectrum to draw from, right? Mm. And I spent, do you know what? I saw strategy on a page which changed. Because that's going back nearly 14, 15 years.
Okay.
Right? It hasn't changed. And now actually what we've got is the tech version, which has come out with it. Just launched Pinpoint, which is the souped-up tech version of strategy on the page. Okay. But the methodology is the same, even in the new fast-moving world, because the same components in business, I think, are timeless. There's a couple of subtleties I'd weave in, but it's on a business-specific basis. But the foundations of business, I think, are the same. And I'm really open-minded on that. I've always, we keep going back every few years. Like, okay, is anything going to change it? No, not really. Just make it better, make it deeper.
Mm.
So And that's what I think, that's the elegance of business.
Brilliant.
Business is actually quite simply elegant if you get to the core, but it's really difficult to get to the simple elegance.
Mm. But I mean, the benefit of all those organizations that you've worked with and the companies that you had yourself, it's given you brilliant inside knowledge to put that together. Now, I know that there'll be listeners who've never heard of strategy on the page. Funnily enough, I know it's hard to believe, Derry, but could you just in a nutshell explain what it is?
So, and it's taking the lessons. There's a number of methodologies out there that are one-page plans. The one-page plan has been around for decades, and there's different versions of it, and it's drawn. It was actually developed a lot for the corporate world. I didn't work in the small space, in the mid space, which is where I play more. So I adapted what was out there. I pulled my best stuff together, and essentially, it is a page plan. Everything is there in one single page. And it begins with purpose, which is why do you exist as a company, and the five elements of purpose, which I go incredibly deep on, right? Vision and values is in there. Values at the core of the page. Shouldn't it just be, Sylvia, talent, talent, strategies, culture is the core. So we just put the major blocks in, and the methodology just enables you to grab those and crystallize those. And that's hard work, by the way. So I don't, a lot of people look at strategy on a page and think that's easy. It's not. Easier to write a massive business plan, which is full of rubbish, and you stick in a drawer. It's a lot harder to crystallize your thinking into what truly matters. Sure. And then the strategy part is looking across the whole spectrum of strategies, marketing, sales, operations, cash, and talent. And bringing that down into execution with measurement. So I won't bore anyone else on any more details of that, but it's an execution tool. Now, the two things that's important on that is one, purpose. I will not ever work with any business that doesn't have absolute true purpose and belief in what they do, because I think that is the magic source. So if I look back and people, how am I sitting on these boards, and why are all these boards successful? Why is our track record for last year through pandemic is most of the businesses that we advise and sit with under the BGI group have grown between 25 and 150%.
Wow.
Pandemic. Now, why is that? Right place, right time, by the way, because we didn't have any airlines or anything else in our portfolio. Sure. That's that's a luck, because some industries can't help it, but mostly because the people we work with are absolutely on purpose and nothing's going to stop them. And that's the magic source, right? So that's the primary is purpose, and the other primary is talent. Talent is the number one strategy. That if I was going to say two things to people that I've learned in two decades, talent is the number one strategy. Cash is also the number one strategy, and it's only because it enables talent. And that you, sure. What comes first, chicken or egg? That's, we can go there. Although actually, you need to be able to raise the capital to be able to hire the right talent to be able to enable the next level of growth. So, but talent for me is everything I believe in.
Brilliant. And you know, you started at a very young age, Derry. You know, with companies, setting up companies, etc. What gave you that belief in yourself? You know, what were you like? You know, when you were younger, did you always have this kind of entrepreneurial spirit? You know, were you kind of selling lemonade on the street when you're age of five? Or you know, how did it start? Where did that courage and that confidence come from?
It wasn't lemonade, it was like bird boxes and stuff, believe it or not. My dad ran the local village shop, so my dad was a real heart of the community. We were from a tiny community in West Wales in a little village called Langham. My dad ran the shop, and he was a salesman through and through. And so I grew up with that, and he just basically he'd sell anything, right? Looking back, not that it was ethical either, by the way. He'd sell sand to the Arabs, my dad would. He literally didn't care. So I was brought up around that environment, which meant if I could, and I was working from an early age. So it's like I love carpentry. So my dad was like, build bird boxes and I'll sell them for you, right? So build this and I'll sell. So I just built stuff and he'd sell it. Or we'd make stuff and he'd sell it. And I just got that in my DNA pretty early. But then my dad, interestingly, if you look at my early triggers, that was it. But my dad failed.
Okay.
So when I was eight, that was my early memories. But then my dad failed. The local shop, it was the 1980s. Supermarkets came in, killed the local businesses, or so my dad thought. That was an excuse, actually, because actually the shop went on and thrived. My dad's belief dropped. And he went on and then worked for somebody else for the rest of his life. He ended up driving buses and running lorries. So my dad was, although he inspired me, to answer your question of where did that come from, discouraged me. So don't think that went on for long, because my dad then was a failed entrepreneur and told me to go and get a good safe job. So he didn't want me, and I know why now, because he was trying to protect me, right? He didn't want me to go through the failure that he felt. But so it was in my blood, but discouraged. And it only started to come through. So I just went to school, went to university, and, you know, went in the corporate track. But I was always an entrepreneur inside. You know, I was almost like the trapped entrepreneur to go and get a good job, son. So I started to have businesses on the side very early. I started to angel invest very early. I just couldn't help myself. Hence where the early businesses came from.
Okay. Brilliant. And what impact did that have on you, Derry? You know, your father being an entrepreneur, running the village shop, quite a high profile figure. And then, as you, in your words, failed. What impact did that have on you?
I was massive. And I was pissed at my dad for years. Okay. Right until the day he died, actually. I don't think I ever forgave him, because I saw my hero give up. And he went on the dole. You know, I was 8 or 9 in the 1980s, and my father was on the dole, which was a big thing back then, right?
Sure.
And he'd gone from the center of the village and the heart of the community to being on the dole. For those who don't understand the dole, it's like welfare, basically. So now I'm the welfare kid when I'm in late primary school. And that made me mad, right?
Yeah.
And also, I saw my dad change. My dad was never the same again after that. He was a great man and a vibrant man, but he lost his confidence. He lost, to him, that was a failure, which it was. And also in a small village. Yeah. I love small villages, and I love the culture that comes with small villages, and I hate small villages and the shit and nonsense that comes with small villages too. So, and it was destructive. It was destructive to my father. So I was pissed, is the truth. And I got mad, and I was like, I'm going to fucking prove everyone wrong. So, and I stepped up, and I think that was a driving force for me. So I don't, you know, God bless him. He regretted it, by the way, this is why I talk about regrets a lot on the stage. And it's one of my most powerful messages, I think. He regretted that massively. And you can start to see part of what drives me, right? Which is, I'm not going out like that. I'm not going out with regret. And that's why I will push through, because I would rather deal with failure than regret. And I'd rather fail epically on all proportions and just ride that storm out than sit there and regret not having a go.
Absolutely. And Derry, when I first heard you speak at the PSA conference, and we're going back about six, seven years, and you told the story about your father on his deathbed, just looking at you and saying, don't live a life of regrets, and the impact that had on you. That has stuck with me since that day. I think about it often, and I often say to people, I often relate your story to people, because that's unbelievably powerful. That must have had a huge impact on you.
It absolutely did. And this is why I speak so openly on the stage, because I think a lot of people resonate with it, right? And even if they, and so many people have lost people close to them. Now, whether they actually verbalize that to them, which my father did with me, he sat on, for those who haven't heard the story, which is most of you, right? You know, my father, I was sat on my father's deathbed. I didn't know that was his deathbed. He died 2 days later. But it was his last words to me. He held my hand and looked into my eyes and said, son, I regret so much in life. And then told me what, and he regretted giving up in business. He regretted not having a go. He had two opportunities to go back into business where partners said, because my dad was a great salesman, great man, everyone loved him. And twice he was offered to go back into partnership with people, and he turned them both down. Both went on to be multi-million pound companies. And, you know, the regret that he lived with was insane. And it was other stupid shit around regret. This is why I got a whole series around regrets and what that means. So that message for me is like, he woke me up. So it's just obviously a huge loss to lose my father. But also I take so much from it, because he woke me up at a time when I wasn't. I was still very committed in the corporate world. I was climbing the wrong ladder. He shook me up. I changed fundamentally at that point in my life, which was now, it's coming up to nearly 18, 20 years ago now that was. So I've been running this, and that's when I just went, no regrets, I'm going all in now. And I'm never going out like that. And equally for my children, right? Because I'm the child, right? That's my father, that's my hero. And that's the legacy he left me. Now, and I witnessed that when I was, so my kids are coming through now, right? And they are watching me, and they're watching me go all in on multiple levels. And they're seeing me climb the highest mountains in the world. They're seeing me do shit that some people shouldn't do. And they're seeing me push the boundaries of business. They're actually involved in it now because I've got the new estate here, and we're living in the manor house next to the site. So they see daddy picking up this basically derelict farm and turning it into an amazing retreat center, and they're watching that. And no matter what happens, if I die tomorrow, my kids will know that daddy went full out, right? And that's what this is about, just inspiring the next generation.
Oh, that is amazing. And you know, I love the fact that you know, completely throw yourself into life at all levels, Derry, and you've had some amazing experiences at the top of the highest mountains and in the desert and everything. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the drive behind this love of extreme sports that you've absolutely embraced for as long as I've known you and beyond that?
Do you know, it started at my father's death, right? Because then I looked myself in the eye, which is one of these primary questions, which is, if I die tomorrow, what would I regret? And I love travel, right? And I love adventure. Yeah. It's one of the top regrets in life. We've done this study now on the top regrets in life, and travel is number six. It's not actually adventure, it is travel. People just regret. It was one of my father's. He wanted to travel more and he didn't. But for me, it was more, I looked at people mountaineering and all that. I thought, I'd love to have a go at that. And that was my moment. I was actually with Tony Robbins. I was doing Tony Robbins Mastery Around the World 20 years ago, this Date with Destiny, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it was one of those moments with Tony Robbins. My father had just died and it was like time to redefine myself. And part of that was adventure. Now I just went, right, what do I want to do? I'd love to, what would I like to have a crack at, right? And I thought, right, poles, North Pole, South Pole, seven highest mountains in the world, run across the Sahara Desert, marathon to Saab, that seems like some crazy shit, jungle marathon and Ironman. And that was my original bucket list, right? Don't ask me why, right? I think if you ask somebody else, it would be yoga, art and theater, right? So it's, everyone's bucket list is different. Mine, that's just where my soul is drawn to. Part of that at the time of signing up to that was egoic. There's no question around that. There was definitely an egoic drive in the early days. And then I threw myself at it, right? So, and I got broken on my first outing when I totally discovered the power of nature, which is a big part of what I'm doing now. I discovered the mother goddess herself in full form, which is you go, and my first outing with Marathon to Saab. So I decided to start all that crazy shit with six marathons across the Sahara Desert. Stupid place to start, by the way. When you're all in, you're all in, right? So, and it really broke me. I finished it successfully, but boy, did I learn something about myself. I was in tears on my knees in the middle of that desert.
I'm going to stop you there, Derry. I'm going to stop you there because I've been reading a little bit about your book, and you said, you know, that was the one that that was one of the ones that really broke you, and you sank to your knees and you asked for a sign, and then something happened. I mean, can you share that, or do we need to read your book to find that out?
Do you know, I don't talk about that very often, Sylvia. So you said you just sneak things out of people. and it, because it's like, I can't explain it, right? But so, yeah, there's me. And it was like, I'd done, so the context is, so people understand, is Marathon Saab, six marathons across the Sahara Desert, you know, a half marathon first day, half marathon second day, and then there's a double marathon in the middle, which really breaks you if you're not finished. So marathon, double marathon, right, across the Sahara. Yeah, nuts job. So I'm in the middle of the double marathon, as you do. Already done a marathon in, and I was about halfway through the second. The night was drawing in. A bad day at the office generally, right? When you've gone that far, you are broken physically, mentally, and emotionally at that point. I'd already been in tears multiple times that day, and I was brought up as a Welshman and we don't cry. So I was just done. So, and I dropped to my knees, had a word with whoever's up above, because I know someone's guiding me and it ain't me half the time, right? So there's somebody much wiser than me above us, and I think it's female in form. I'm praying it is, because it's way smarter than the bloke's ego energy, that's for sure, right?
Love it.
And I just said, why am I here, what am I doing? Now I won't go into the answer to what I got on that, which was profound in its own right, but I said, give me a sign. And literally I looked into the sand. I'm in the middle of the desert, right? In the middle of the Sahara Desert. And there's this little silver ring.
Oh, my God.
In the sand. And I was just like, okay, I'll shut up and get on with it. And I put the ring on my little finger, got up, packed my bags and carried on, right? Because you go, ask for a sign, get a silver ring with an Arabic scripture on the side of it in the middle of the Sahara. That's good enough for me to say, crack on, finish this race, right? And shut up, there's something bigger than us going on. Now, I'll never be able to explain that. It wasn't even on a campsite or anything like this. I mean, it's middle of the dunes. And that ring stayed with me. I had it around my neck for about 8 years. And sadly, I lost it when during the Ironman race, which was quite devastating for me. But the ring will always be with me, and it'll always be a signal to what I did. So I always do when it's something when I'm in the middle of the biggest shitstorm, I always just I seek higher counsel than me, because there's much greater wisdom out there. And I believe that wisdom is in nature.
Oh, definitely.
And that's why I'm building what I'm building now, and what I'm doing now is getting people back into nature. Because all of my really profound shifts, everything that I've done since, so it started in the desert, then I went to the highest mountains in the world, climbing ultimately in Everest and the Himalaya. Nature is just incredible and beautiful. We should be protecting nature. We shouldn't be screwing it up. My profound moments have been in nature, and we're building a place of rewilding here where people can. There's something about connecting rawness, connecting, having your feet in the grass, having your feet in the lakes, connecting to nature, because that's who we are, right? That's what our essence is. So all of those lessons in nature, you know, brought me back to do what I'm doing today, which is, let's bring people back to nature, shall we? Because I think it's got a lot to teach us.
Oh, totally agree. You're speaking my language, Derry. I totally get that. I also remember talking to you and hearing you speak about that episode in Everest where there was the avalanche and I think you lost a member of your party. And I remember you telling the story about, you know, eventually getting to a camp with your men. And you said, you think grown men don't cry. They do, as you pass the satellite phone round and they connected with, you know, their families. You know, I mean, that stuck in my mind for a long time. And, you know, so what is it that you can... that you find to tap into when you're literally faced with death, as you were on that episode? What happens? What goes on in your head? Where do you find the strength from?
Do you know what? This is where this no regrets piece comes from. I've been challenged quite a lot by positive psychologists and coaches, etc.
Okay.
Because if you think about living life with no regrets, if you died tomorrow, what would you regret? It's like, oh, no, you should be thinking of the positive. And this, I'm like, bollocks, actually. If you actually, we should contemplate death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that sounds weird to a lot of people, but we're going to die, right? We're all going to be dying. And I've spent a lot of time contemplating that, because I've thrown myself into stupid situations where I've faced it, right? Now, the first couple of times you face it, it's a bit scary, right? And you go, oh, okay. Now, what if I'm okay with dying, then the important part is not the dying bit, it's the living bit.
Okay.
So my daughter asked me this question, bless her, my middle daughter, Eliana. So we just hang out and we have our special time. And this was about a couple months ago. She said, and she went, Daddy, you're not scared of anything, are you? And I said, I'm not a massive fan of heights, which I'm not, by the way. Huge spiders don't particularly thrill me. And she said, what's your biggest fear then? You talk about fear, Daddy, because she knows that I've done this TED talk on fear, right?
Yeah.
Which she shouldn't be looking at, because there's naughty, technically naughty words in that. She looked at her and she went, what's your fear, Daddy? And I went, my greatest fear is living a life of mediocrity, which is back to regret, right? So this is not, I know that if I die tomorrow, and I don't want to, by the way, I have four beautiful children. I have no desire to. I want to live as long as humanly possible. This is why health optimization is a big part of what I do. I live and breathe health optimization. My glycan age, which is your biological age, which I have tested, is 22 right now, right? So,
wow.
So I take this shit seriously, because I want to be here as long as humanly possible for my children.
Yeah.
Because my father wasn't. So I want to be here as long as humanly possible, but I do not want to be here as long as humanly possible, like my grandparents were, living out and eking out the last 15 years of their life, watching soap operas, smoking, and just being in an armchair. Mm-hmm. I want to go all in for the time I'm here. Right. So that means living full out.
Yes.
So when I, in the moment of shitstorm, which happens, I just have to recenter myself, which is meditation is a huge part of my life. Right. Mm-hmm. I meditate so I can get to that center place when the shitstorm's happening all around. I think that's a big misunderstanding in meditation, by the way. I think a lot of people, and it took me probably about 15 years to work out meditation, because everyone's saying you should meditate. And I was like sitting there going, oh, and it's not really doing it for me. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what's going on. Because I think it's missold. And different things, different forms of meditation work for different people.
Mm.
Right? So, you know, what works for me is much more movement meditation. And actually, I've got the science behind it, using Muse bands and stuff now. But my job in meditation is training myself to be able to go to my center and go to my highest power and to be able to sit there and know where it is and know that the voice that is true, not rather than the voice that is not.
Mm.
Now, if I can do that regularly on a good day, right, my job is to get there in a shitstorm.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. That's the key to this. Now, and there's a lot of people go, right, shitstorm's happening. Let me learn to meditate. I'm like, too late.
Yeah.
You should have tried that 10 years ago. And that's the point of it. So I know that's, hopefully that's not a too rounded answer to your question, Sylvia, but I can't answer that question without people understanding my focus on the meditative state, because when the shitstorm happens and fear kicks in, your mind is blown. You can go to fear mode. That just shuts everything down. And now you're stuffed, by the way.
Yeah.
Fight or flight. Whatever, your whole brain's rewired. In those moments, and I'm like, this is the moment. So on Everest, earthquake hits. We know we're the highest men in the world. I was alone. Shit. So don't get me wrong, there was about 2 minutes of panic because the whole Himalaya avalanched. I'm in the middle of the pinnacle that we were on. Ice was crashing all around. We were in one of the most dangerous places on Earth right there.
Mm.
Now then, when that was happening, and thankfully I was in the right place at the right time, and that is hugely important, literally, I'm the luckiest guy alive, I think, and this is why I keep going, right? In that moment, my job was then to calm down quickly, evaluate quickly, and make decisions quickly in a state of calm. Because if you try to make decisions in a state of panic or fear, you're stuffed. So, and I've done that. Now, I didn't learn that on Denali. I nearly shat my pants on Denali many years before when I fell and had an ice axe arrest, right? And I panicked the shit out of that when I nearly killed myself. So don't get me wrong. I have not been perfect on this journey by any stretch of imagination, but I learn. I learn very quickly. And that's the key, which is it's the key to resilience, right? Oh boy, I'll shut up now because I know you're going to cut me off in a minute. But a lot of people, I've co-authored books on the chapters on resilience. I've spoken, a lot of people read, I don't actually put it up as one of my genres, but a lot of people come to me in resilience and I go, and they say, you know, resilience, Derry, how do you become resilient? By doing tough things by scaring yourself and learning and going again. It's like, it feels like there's some people are trying to teach some magic woo thing of like, ooh, resilience. You'll just become resilient. No, you have to do shit to become resilient, right? You have to face shit to do. You don't just become resilient, which is bizarre to me. And they go, so how do you get resilient on mountains? By climbing mountains, by facing fear regularly, by learning it. I'm like, shit, my pants trying to learn how to ice axe climb for the first time. That's how you build resilience. So, I get off a soapbox because I could go all day long about the resilience piece, but it comes to just experience and going for it, right? That's the game.
It's amazing. And I think I remember also you saying that when you meditate at high altitude, it's like a completely different experience.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Absolutely. I want to study. I'm going to do some more studies around this because I want to go back to Tibet. It was a surprise to me the first few times it happened, and I thought it was an accident. And then in the Himalaya, definitely not. So, and if you think about it, think about the Buddhist monks and where all their temples are.
Yeah, that's true.
And as you go up through Tibet, so we came in when I climbed Everest. I climbed north side, which was very few people go in from the north side. All the stuff you see on the tally, that's the south side through Nepal. We came in through Tibet, and as you go further and further in, right up to base camp, there is a monastery at base camp in Tibet. absolutely amazing. But we literally, you could see all the monasteries are up high.
Yes.
Now, you tell me that there's a clue there, right? So, and it is. I stand at such a high altitude, it's mind-altering. High altitude is mind-altering. You are, it's low oxygen, right? Now, they're a bit more acclimatized than we are, obviously. But there's no question. When I meditate in high altitude, it's like a 3D, it's a 3D version, wow. 2D version of meditation there. And I spent 3 days and three nights on the north face of Everest at just, you know, 6,500 meters. And I can tell you that was deep, deep meditation up there. And also a lot to contemplate because the earthquake had just happened. So
yeah.
I had a few things to process, shall we say, and the Mother Goddess helped me process them.
So what were the key takeaways from that then, Derek? Because it must have had a massive impact on you, because there you were facing death yet again, you know.
Yeah, it's stupid. I keep coming back. Do you know what? It was almost like a life review. So obviously the earthquake hit, we carried on climbing. We didn't quite know what we were in until later on the sat phone where we worked out the true extent. So 9,000 people died in Nepal that day. And it's the biggest death rate on the mountain in history. So, you know, we were there. There was 19 of my fellow climbers died that day in that instant, right? So that's being on Everest in the biggest death rate on Everest is a big story, right? So now we were on the north side of the mountain. We're the highest men in the world. And there was no rescue because helicopters can't go that high. So you understand the context of where we're in.
I do.
And then we're sitting there, and I'll tell the sat phone story another time of passing the sat phone around the tent, but you sit there, and now I'm spending time. Now, we were actually still on for summit. So there was we had a technicality. We were the only men on the mountain now, and we were still technically able to go for summit, and we were ready. And never before had Everest, you've had Everest yourself. So that was interesting decision-making criteria. But in that moment, as we started to recognize just the scale of what we were in, you know, you sit in our tents, and the storms were coming in, so you get a lot of time to process, right? So what was my processing of that was I was able to review the previous decade since my father's death. And do you know what? I had no regrets. And that's, now, if I'd have died just after my dad's death, I would have gone out with a shitload of regrets just like my dad. Indeed. I went to work for 10 years. I changed my businesses. I built businesses to be proud of. I built businesses that had philanthropic impact. I had built businesses that made impact in the world. I got my beautiful children. You know, I had done the right things. I'd done the marathon to Saab and the mountains and everything else. I was living in the countryside. So I came out of the city. I'd done it. And I mean, the whole spectrum of life. Regrets trickle across all of life, which is Diamond Life Design, which is the whole piece of work I do in life architecture, right? And I could honestly sit on Everest, go, if I'm done today, which I could have been, I don't want to go, but I'm going out full tilt, having lived a life of no regrets, right? What was then profound was, what do I do next? Yeah. And that was more of the same, bigger impact. And that's when I came back from Everest. And that's the journey I've been on for the last 5 years now, right? So 6 years now. So it is like, how do I make even bigger impact in the world? And more importantly, I saw the power of Mother Nature unleashed on Everest. And this is where nature started to begin its course. We are destroying nature on so many different levels. Now I'm leaning into that agenda. I want to make sure we're bringing big investments into reforestation, or rewilding, eco agenda. And that's the piece I want to stand behind, because I built businesses to be proud of, but I'm not actually solving some of the planet's problems. And so now for the last 5 years, I've step changed into, let's solve some of the big planet's problems. And I want to be part of that. And I will enable anyone as part of that. And we're raising millions in that space now across multiple businesses to do good. And that's the change, right? So I have to almost die a little to wake up. And this is my message with no regrets. I'm hoping, I want to just, everyone listening to this, if I can do nothing else than reach through and just slap you and just say, wake up. If you haven't had a death, if you haven't had lost somebody close to you, if you haven't had a serious illness, if you haven't had a what's always called second lifers, right? If you haven't had that, great. Don't let that come before you make the change. Make the change without that. And I wish I'd been sensible enough or wise enough to make the change without it. And I wasn't. It took my dad to die for me to wake up. It took me to look death in the eye several times to wake up again and again and awaken more. And I don't believe that you need those. Sadly, so many people that resonate, it's like, oh yeah, I lost someone and it felt the same for me. So why is it that as human beings, we have to lose someone or lose ourselves to be able to really live? And that's the bit I'm hoping this message kind of enables people before the shitstorms come.
Brilliant message, Derry. Absolutely love that. So can you just give us a couple of minutes on what you're doing now? Because that's so interesting. And I want our listeners to know what you're up to now.
I still sit on multiple boards, right? So, but most of my boards are impact boards. I'm a big fan of impact investment. So bringing, I've been in venture capital circuits and PE and all the rest of it. I'm actually interested in impact investment that's going to do massive good on the planet. Part of that is the Raglan Country Estate, which is what I've got out here in the Welsh borders. So we're rewilding a 227 acre estate now, where we're bringing eco units, ecotourism, rewilding at its core, sustainability through everything, and bringing people back to nature. So truly bringing people back to nature so people can get out of the city and reconnect to themselves, to the friends, to the family properly. And building a retreat center right at the heart of it. So I'm a massive fan of retreats, as I know you are, Sylvia. Yeah. I want to be able to lead leadership retreats, bring my best friends from around the world. They want to lead leadership retreats in an amazing environment, which is sustainable and eco and still luxurious, right? So that's what we're building. It's already started. It's already away. The units are going down, starting to go down in the next few weeks of the build. So and this isn't the first site. We plan to do this across the world, right? So I think we need a place to connect. And part of that is to facilitate transformation. I have transformed in nature.
Yes.
Through the crazy shit I've done.
Yes.
Now, most of you do not wish to climb the Himalaya or run across the deserts. Good for you. Don't blame you. But I would suggest you connect with nature. And this, the connection to nature, I think, inspires and empowers all of us. And I think if everyone connected back to nature properly and felt it and touched it, we'd stop fucking the world up.
I totally agree.
And that's my agenda. And we're doing that in all levels. We're looking to create solar farms out here, regenerative projects, sustainability projects, even the golf course. Our plans are to be the most sustainable golf course in the UK. We've already stopped using all forms of chemicals and pesticides and all that kind of stuff. And they're now working on how we can rewild that. But that's what I'm playing with right now. But we're playing with this on multiple businesses and multiple projects because it's like it's back to nature. I think humanity has never needed connection more. And we need to connect to nature first. And we've got to connect to ourselves first. And then if we can truly connect with ourselves and nature, we can connect with other human beings on a much more profound level. So that's the next decade, I think, for me. And that's going to keep me busy. I reckon I'm going till 106 because I'm that lucky, as you know already. So there's plenty more in me. But I think this one will keep me busy for a while.
Yeah, sounds absolutely wonderful, Derry. How can people find out more about you? Where can they find you, Derry?
Derry.live. So we've got the new brand, Derry.live, Derri.live. That's typically the signposting place of what I'm doing personally. We throw up loads of content there just for general exposure. I'm not really, I don't sell the courses and all that kind of stuff because it's not what I do these days. But I want to keep the inspirational message going. So like the Six Regrets series is there. It's freely available for people.
Brilliant.
So that's the channel to inspire through. And that's going to keep changing. I've just been off the map a little bit building this project for the last year, but that's going to evolve.
And your book, A Life of Adventure, I'm just sort of reading the first few chapters, but it's fascinating. So really recommend that. So I'll put links to that and your site on the show notes. Derry, it's been an absolute pleasure. There's so much more we could unpack and time has just flown by. But I always ask my guests, have you got one last message you could just leave with the listeners before we bring this to a close?
Well, that's an easy one, right? That's live a life and build a business of no regrets. That's always going to be my core. And I think if we can just play to that philosophy, and it's life and business. And I think there's regrets, a lot of the times there's regrets in one or the other. And that's why I mentioned both. So live a life of no regrets and build a business of no regrets. Or be in a career of no regrets for those who don't build businesses. And that's my philosophy through and through.
Thank you so much for joining me today on the Becoming More Significant podcast. And I really hope that you've taken away some practical steps to take right now to help you unlock more of that hidden potential that we are all only scratching the surface of. If you would like to discuss how I might be able to support you in your journey into greater significance, please get in touch. It's calendly.com/SylviaBaldock for a no obligation, free initial coaching call to find out how together we can make sure that the coming weeks and months are your most significant ever. Take care.